friends, you are listening to Red Ice Creations Radio. I am your host, Henrik Palmgren, and we are coming to you from the west coast of Sverige. You can hear us every Thursday and Sunday through our website, redicecreations.com. And welcome to our Thursday program, and we have our good friend and regular guest, Michael Tessarion, back with us on the program for his monthly spot. And we're a few Thursdays behind in the schedule, but that's okay. It's always a good time to have Michael on and get a chance to talk about his work and research. And if you're new to Michael's work, there are a few websites that you need to check out right away. And beyond accessing our radio archive with shows that we have with Michael right on redicecreations.com, you need to check out michaeltessarion.com. And from there, you'll find links to his most essential sites, like taroscopes.com, originsandoracles.com, and irishoriginsbook.com. And today, we are going to talk about one of the more controversial areas of Michael Tessarion's work. And this is about the West to East movement, and we're going to address the land bridges that connected the continents of the world during the megalithic times. And this is really the first thing you need to address, I think, in order to make people look into this area, because it's a total reverse, basically, of the commonly known theories about how civilization has moved and where it first came from. And this is also, of course, about that England and Ireland, or the British Isles, was a part of Atlantis. So with this focus on Ireland, the role of Ireland in world history, and considering that you, Michael, have a past living in Ireland, is this an area that you've been studying and working with for a long time, Michael?
Yeah, it started back in 1979. Also, thanks again for giving me the opportunity to delve into this, because you know, the new book is going to be pretty much out very shortly. You know, and again, it wasn't planned, like the Atlantis book. None of this was planned. So I started writing it about a year ago, so we're really on schedule. You know, people who've fans of the Origins and Oracles series of DVDs will know that there was a huge wait while I, you know, potted around trying to get everything right. So people were delayed about a year, you know, waiting for that series to come out. But actually, we're really on target with the new book. Started in earnest writing about it last year, and then, you know, it's going to be out this summer or late summer anyway. But the process actually began. It was always a hobby. It's not something, again, I've looked to physically writing about, you know. I mean, there's so many books on the Celts and, you know, goddess worship and on the Druids and things like that. It never really occurred to me until last year, almost this time last year, to write my own book on it. But I have studied the subject of Celtic mythology and Irish mythology for a long time. But it started in 1979 when I was in school in Belfast. At that time, a beautiful book of art had come out by a famous Celtic artist who lives in Dublin by the name of Jim Fitzpatrick.
Yeah.
People who don't know about Jim Fitzpatrick, you know, better start getting into him. He was an album cover designer. He did most of the covers for the band Thin Lizzy. He was personal friends with that heavy metal band, and he's also a really knowledgeable guy when it comes to, you know, Irish mythology.
And you have a few of those pictures even on your website now, I think, right?
Right, and that's by permission. Actually, I'm glad you brought that up. I've actually, you know, been in contact with Jim for several years, and he's been very supportive, actually. Mm-hmm. I mean, the cover of my Atlantis book, people who've got that book will know that that's a Jim Fitzpatrick painting. I mean, this guy basically contributed that artwork, you know. He's really been extraordinarily helpful. He's just a really gem of a guy. People who don't know about him, actually... It's funny, you know that Che Guevara image, that very, very famous Che Guevara image that people wear in their T-shirts, and it's sort of like this black and white type. That's his drawing, by the way.
Really?
Yeah, from way back in the 60s, that icon, you know, it's almost like an Andy Warhol icon.
Yeah.
Well, that very famous image of the great revolutionary Che Guevara with his beret, that was actually painted by Jim Fitzpatrick. So he's a famous commercial artist, you know, and so forth and so on. But in 1979, he released two books that were just sort of art books, you know, in that sort of Roger Dean, Rodney Matthews style. And they were superbly done, you know. They were, and more important than that is that they were about ancient Irish history. I didn't know about it. I didn't care about any of that stuff. I was just in school. And it was actually a really, it was a friend, if you want to use that term, a schoolmate that actually, we were in art class, actually, now I come to think of it, and the art teacher had this book. I think we stole the book or something on the art teacher because it was sitting on his desk. And I just, you know, always liked art. And I'm not a good artist, but I've always liked art. And anyway, this book was sitting on the table, and it was called Celtic. No, what was it called? It was called The Book of Conquests. Okay. After, again, after a very old book, there's a very ancient book called The Book of Conquests that's actually truly called the Liber Gabala, the Book of Invasions or the Book of Conquest. And so he had done a sort of a, you know, almost a, like a stylized, you know, rock poster type of book, you know, on that subject. And it was actually my schoolmate who said, yeah, but have you read it? I didn't even realize it was text in the book until I, you know, looked at it more carefully. And I suddenly noticed, you know, oh, there's writing there. And he goes, yeah, you should read that. You know, and he said it very affirmatively.
Yeah.
And, of course, that's a bit taboo because I went to a Protestant school. I mean, I don't give a damn about religion, but, you know, I was stuck in a Protestant school. And this is a book on Celtic. And I get, you know, get this. This is very important to understand that this is not something that normally in Protestant school you would find.
Yeah.
But the art teacher had it because it was just he was interested in the art. The stories, however, are highly taboo, mm-hmm. to, you know, for the Northern Ireland Protestant community because that's just, you know, the divisions that exist in their minds. Anyway, so I was kind of a bit unusual that this guy, you know, from a Protestant school would be even sort of nudging me to read the text, you know. But again, you know, even in the north of Ireland, the Protestant community still very much, you know, teach their children about Finn McCool and Coolhullin, you know. It's not completely sequestered. And in the language, the sort of Gaelic idioms, you know, still occur. And so it's not completely gone or anything like that. So, you know, I did actually, I think we stole the book for a couple of days, you know, and wanting something to read, I actually read the book, and this completely blew my mind, because there's me living in Ireland, you know, growing up in Ireland, and never having a clue about Ireland or anything remotely about its ancient past. Basically, like a lot of people, that you know, I'm trying now to wake them up. Well, I was in that state, you know. Ireland was just Ireland to me. It didn't, you know, it didn't have a culture. It didn't have a history. Reading this book, of course, changed all that. And also the something about the beautiful artwork, you know, yeah, okay, it was stylized and everything, but it really worked with the right brain. And Jim Fitzpatrick's own story, you know, of how he was almost in a trance-like state when he wrote the book, and, you know, he was having visions.
Really?
You know, oh, yeah, he was totally immersed in, he still is, pretty much in the culture, you know, and he had some very, you know, transportative experiences, you know. He lives in Dublin, but, so that opened my eyes, and gladly, as you said, yes, he's given me a lot of permission to use his artwork and so forth and so on to enhance my work, which is fantastic, very generous of him. But then I think in 82, during a period of time when I was in America, then it was a passion. So it was moving from just a general interest, you know, actually moving from no interest to general interest, and then within a two-year period, it became like extremely important.
Yeah.
And there was a couple of reasons for that. Is one, it tied in, I made the connection in my mind from reading a little bit, that there is no difference really between the famous Arthurian legends of England and these more primordial Celtic legends. I mean, they, Celtic legends have an Artur.
Yeah.
They actually have an Artur. You know, they have an equivalent of Lancelot, you see. They also have many of the recognizable characters. In fact, the sword of Arthur, King Arthur's Excalibur, is based on a much earlier sword of the High King of Ireland, which was called Retaliator. So not only the people, the characters, you know, even Shakespeare's King Lear is based on Lir, L-I-R, or Lear, you know, who, God of the Sea, of the ancient Irish. So we got a lot of crossover here, and the Arthurian legends are almost a re-scripting of Celtic legends that happened in Ireland before they got into the Arthurian tradition. And I'd always been interested in the Arthurian tradition. So when I realized that, wait a minute, these things are not separate, they can't be considered separate, that was very interesting. And so in 82, I start really researching it. And then in 85, sorry to be so long-winded about this, but there actually is a long, long, you know, sequence of events.
Sure, yeah.
In 85, it moved out of just reading stuff, because believe me, there wasn't really that much to read, especially if you're living in north of Ireland. They're not interested in this subject. There's very few bookstores that would carry any of this stuff. Yeah, if you got a big university degree and a budget, you can probably find old books in libraries, but you know, generally these books did not exist on the shelves of most bookstores in those days. We didn't have, you know, metaphysical bookstores and stuff, so it was a little bit tricky to even get reading material on this subject. But around about, and of course, we didn't have the internet. That really matters.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, but see, around 95, it changed from reading about it to actually going out into the field in Ireland. And if you ever wanted confirmation that the books and the official line is total lies, that's what you would need to do.
Mm.
So after about a year or two of looking at the megalithic sites, going out and studying them quite meticulously, you know, even working with sacred geometry, measuring things on maps, you know, literally going out in thunderstorms to look at very obscure, remote standing, you know, not just the famous ones that everybody, all the tourists go, hey, honey, that's great, take a photo. Those famous ones, but there's lots and lots of really unknown ones that exist in the back of people's gardens, you know. So mm-hmm, it's a situation of us pulling up in, you know, thunderstorm weather, going knock, knock, knock. Excuse me, do you have a stone circle in your back garden? Could we go and take a look at it? Yeah, son, come on in, you know, trudge on through here. Yeah, we're used to this, you know. So the mavericks in their Wellington boots, you know, would stomp through these poor people's houses and out to the back, and then they'd pull aside, you know, these plants or whatever, and go, yeah, there it is. And then, my God, these people had, you know, they didn't even know what they had in their back garden. Because, again, you know, if you're really into the subject, you realize it's not just a matter of stone circles in their back garden or major standing stones or these other pictograms with spirals, faces on it. These are also geomantic sites.
Mm-hmm.
You're not just talking about the rocks themselves. You end up talking about the vortex. I mean, why, you know, we're talking about hills and valleys and the positioning of these things. You're into an entire subject. And then my mind works in sort of I don't know, weird ways. I wasn't just running around like some sort of, you know, Celtic scholar going, oh, great, look what we found. I kept noticing that when we ever go out to look at any of these things, you know, there'd be like Christian churches planted right on top. You know, you get this bit, or nunneries, or off limits, or I would start noticing that, hang on a minute, there looks like there's been an active campaign of destruction of these things, you know, like sequestering of these, certainly the what you would call the willful destruction of many of the sites. Mm-hmm. And granted, a lot of this is done just by the farmers and the local yokels, but it was, I start to notice back in the mid 80s that this seemed to be demolition that had been done also purposely. Started to connect some dots, and so of course that would, you know, then be looking at the thing conspiratorially, which I never did originally. This is what got me into a lot of this. In fact, these investigations started to show me that something was seriously amiss. Because every time that we'd find a plot, you know, sort of like almost like Indiana Jones in a way, you go out and you'd absolutely know that on the map here is a missing stone circle or a missing megalithic site. Let's go and see if it's there.
Mm.
You'd find yourself looking up at a big giant church.
Isn't that,
oh, we can't find it. Let's lean against this church and, Jesus, wonder where that thing went. You know, the next day, Jesus, wonder where that stone circle is, as you're leaning up against another church or another college or another institute or another Jesuit, you know, whatever, missionary or whatever. You go, gee, we can't seem to find any of those ancient Celtic sites. Wonder where they could be, you know, until even a dumb dummy like me would go, okay, wait a minute, but we are finding a lot of churches.
Yeah.
Well, finally, it starts to go, wait a minute, has somebody been building on top of these? You know, so you're finding all sorts of stuff. And then, of course, you bump into these people who give you the official line. I mean, if you go to any famous place, you end up having a guided tour. And, my God, that's just a lie factory, that is. 2 minutes of, you know, independent research, and you can realize, wait a minute, what's going on here? And you find that these, you know, teenage girls or whatever, you know, or these, I don't know, graduates, undergraduates or whatever they're called, you know, of Trinity or some other Irish, you know, institution, are hired, you know, in the summer to take the tourists.
Reading from the paper what it's
exactly
about,
you know. Reading from some script, and you barely can raise, and I didn't have to raise my hand because other tourists were doing it. I was shocked on some of these things I went, where gentlemen from New Zealand, you know, other very educated people, probably a lot more than I was at that time, would be doing the refutation. I mean, I was well in there too, you know, arguing away, but I wasn't the only one. A lot of these people from America and a lot of people from New Zealand were already asking questions, and I was so glad to see that. You know, there's me with my Motorhead t-shirt ready to get in their face. Well, I don't think that's quite right, you know. But actually, very ordinary people were refuting it right there, getting into, you know, sort of like soft arguments with, you know, because they've been brought up on Arthur C. Clarke and, you know, other scholars in America. So they'd come to Ireland and they had questions and they weren't buying into this rubbish that had been generated from the universities. That was really cool. But actually, after all that time going out and looking at you know, the ancient sites. I mean, my brother still to this day believes that Kilpatrick, which is the famous Mountain of Patrick, it's a very famous Catholic site now, where every year, you know, the Catholics do a major sort of ritualistic ascent of the famous mountain. It's in Galway, you know, and it's visited by thousands and thousands and thousands of Roman Catholics all over the world. Especially in Ireland, there's specific days in which they'll, you know, go to this place. My brother to this day believes that that could be a pyramid, you know, like those ones in Bosnia.
Really?
Yeah, he's ready to go with a shovel and start digging it up. You know, like, he's really adamant that the shape of that mountain. And there's rumors, you know, I mean, Queen Maeve's grave, you know, I mean, there's man-made stuff, I mean, of giant proportion in Ireland. So, you know, one day we may actually discover that that mountain of Kilpatrick was even made by man. You know, nothing can surprise us anymore. So that's basically what happened. Then, you know, it became an earnest study from that time on, and it demolished every traditional official story that I'd been hearing about Ireland. And basically then you've got to tear that down, and gradually you've got to start building up a new picture of Ireland that is not in the ordinary Irishman's consciousness, that is not traditionally mentioned in any history books or school, and is basically very taboo. And then, as I said, my mind working in sort of these subversive ways started to focus in more on who's been messing with this? Who's writing these scripts that these people are talking? I mean, you can't go that wrong. You know? So this is what then sort of skewed my own perception. And as I started to follow that down, you know, and a friend and colleague of mine, Andy Power, who wrote the book Ireland, Land of the Pharaohs, he was on a similar tradition, looking into the hidden, what we would now refer to as the occult history of Ireland. You see? So this thing has taken, you know, 20 years or so to rebuild that mosaic, to rebuild a picture of Ireland. But in doing that, it has also sought to expose those people who've had a penchant or a vested interest in hiding the truth. So my book is in no way to be considered just a normal book on, you know, goddess tradition or Celts or pagans. This is a book that revolutionizes what we know about the world as well, and about the sort of hierarchy of control that's what's going on, you know. But for a layman's point of view, the book is definitely a very... It dwells very heavily on the connections between Egypt, for instance, and Ireland. It talks about a reappraisal, as we've been saying, of the British Isles. It does talk about these land bridges. And it most importantly focuses on the idea that the elements of civilization did not move from the eastern lands to the west, as we have been told in school, but in earlier times from the west to the east. So I don't mean that there's been no migrations of significance from the east. There were many. But those are dated to 7,000 years BC, you know, to 10,000 years BC, and it is utterly preposterous to start history. They're literally opening the book of history at those times. 10,000 years BC, you know, back even further, 15,000 years BC, there was earlier migrations in what's known as the Mesolithic period, from the east, from the west into the east. And that many of the migrations that are known historically from the east to the west are returns, as a matter of fact. This is the most important word in this lexicon concerning the Irish origins of history is return. Return, that is a very, very important, that's the word they've left out, that many of these subsequent migrations of Scythians, you see, and Israelites, and all sorts of Phoenicians, you name it, are return journeys back to the land of the ancestors. And this is why, when you study the, go out into the field, and you start discovering pharaohs are buried in Ireland, or princesses of Egypt are buried in Ireland, and so on, and traditions talking about even the prophet Jeremiah being in Ireland, you know, it starts to make sense when you consider that these are not initial visitations to Ireland. They're either returns or they're journeys back to the land of the ancestors, to the old land of the Eldar. This is what has to be, is crucially to be understood.
And one thing we could bring up right away, I guess, you said 15,000 years, about something like that. This brings me back to an article that we had up on Red Ice here a few weeks ago, called Egypt's Oldest Known Art Identified. It's 15,000 years old, and these are etchings at Quarta, I think it's pronounced, I'm not sure. Located about 400 miles or 640 kilometers south of Cairo, Egypt. And one of the guys, you know, down there heading this, dig, well, it's not a dig maybe, but he said that It's not at all an exaggeration to call this the Lascaux of the Nile, you know, or on the Nile, basically. And of course, this is tying it back to the cave paintings in France, you know, and even similar to in Spain. And one of the paragraphs, you know, in this article was like this: in the meantime, the findings has raised a big question. How were people in Western Europe and Southern Egypt producing almost identical artwork at the same time?
That's right. And this find, there's many finds, but this specific find, because it's been in Egypt, because the artwork has been clearly identified as similar to those in Lascaux, is of monumental importance. Mm. I think I have the file. I don't know if I put it on my own forum, but believe me, this is... I've always spoken in my other work about the age of revealing and how we're in the countdown to an age in which we're discovering the origins of our destiny. When I see this stuff, it's very inspiring, because that it corroborates this, you know, particular premise that I have about that we're living in the age of revealing, and we are going to be discovering things that shatter all these myths. And you're talking 15,000 years ago. That takes it back into what is known as the Mesolithic period, the period that I'm talking about, the megalithic period, and the Mesolithic period. And of course, you know, Hierakonpolis, one of the most ancient cities in Egypt, is a place called Hierakonpolis. They can read about it in the forthcoming book. Again, it's known to have been a place of sun worship, solar worship. Some of the first sun temples were there. You know, Caucasian pharaohs are known to have ruled from there. You know, we've got traditions. And in fact, the interesting thing about Egypt is that when you actually studying, a lot of people who've studied Egypt probably won't realize this, but when you're studying Egypt, you are studying Ireland. It's just that people haven't made the connection before, because they've been trained like seals to believe that there's no connection between these places. Yeah. And we'll get to the land bridge thing, because that contributes as to why people may have thought there's no connection. But when you're finding parrot feathers in Egypt, they shouldn't be there because they only should be in South America. When you're finding cocaine and coca leaves, you know what I mean, that shouldn't be in Egypt. And when you're finding elephants in South America where they shouldn't be, you know, we got questions already from those connections.
Yeah.
We have one thing that really has to be understood, and I think it will help a lot for people to get around this idea, is that when you're talking about pre-dynastic Egypt, first of all, Egypt's meant to have been about 32 to 33 dynasties long.
Mm.
But anyone who's really seriously studied Egypt knows that the first dynasty of Egypt is not the first dynasty. That's an official date given that's probably, you know, has been refuted by many, many scholars. Okay. It's not accurate. So even though the first dynasty was about 3,600 years B.C., we have to understand that Egypt's history goes further back than that.
Mm.
And when you go back before the first official dynasty of Egypt, about 3,600 years B.C., you come to the time of the official building of the pyramids.
Mm-hmm.
So the pyramid building does not even fit into the normal 32 What was going on in the 32 dynasties? It must have been so great when the pyramids are before those 32 dynasties. Yeah, that's what I call great.
Yeah. Sheesh. So there's a tremendous connection here, again, going back. But you know, one thing I guess that is important also in your work is the defining of Ireland itself, of course, and what it is and the area, and then what we refer to as, you know, the Irish people, for instance, that this now has been, you know, we see it as a very small country, you know, up on the on the British Isles. But I guess what you're saying a bit here also is that this was more wide span, the people itself was more wide span, so to speak.
Well, yeah, exactly. Let's probably, you know, define the reason why I really called the book The Irish Origins of Civilization, because it's a controversial term, and it's purposely designed. It was a very, very specific reason why this book was called that, because it's fundamental. My work always undermines the fallacies that we hold about things. Okay, so what do we know about Ireland today? A tiny nothing country, right? Off the eastern seaboard, you know, completely remote, certainly not on the map as far as anything historical is that concerned. We know it has an ancient culture, but the Romans barely got in there, you know, from a historical point of view. It's not that important. The Roman Empire, you know, is thought to barely have got there, et cetera, et cetera.
Sure.
And we do know, okay, the monks contributed to preserving the Christian, you know, teachings during the so-called Dark Ages.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're listening to, you know, Andrei, what is his name, Anatoly Fomenko, hey, there wasn't even any Dark Ages, so, you know, we can get into all of that.
Yeah.
But you better believe that a few new scientific discoveries, you know, shatter this little idea that we have about Ireland. The reason why I named the book Irish Origins of Civilization is not because I'm talking about the Ireland that people are thinking about when they're listening to us right now. That little island, the Green Island, you know, off the coast of England. That's not what the word meant. Ireland, the word Irish, does not represent a nation or a race. The word is a corruption of the word Irish with an A, or the area, right? We get the word area, you know, like an area of ground from this. Originally, it came from Eri, or meaning the goddess. It was old, one of the oldest names of the goddess was Eri, E-R-I, but vowels interchanged, so she was often called Ari, A-R-I. And the Aria are the pure ones, or the noble ones, the men of light, the men of truth, etc. It was an old name for the Druids. So the most important thing to remember is that 3,000 years BC, there were land bridges that connected the continent and Scandinavia to England. And there was a land bridge that connected England to Ireland. So if you do this in your mind and you think about these land bridges, then you see the connections between England and Ireland are no different than the connections now between Holland and Denmark. Or Sweden and Norway. So out the window, as soon as these land bridges are accepted, and believe me, these are not hallucinations that somebody's dreamt up. These are, you know, photographed from the satellites. They know they existed. Once you accept that these land bridges existed, you don't have a Europe in the way that we understand it today. We are in deficit. Our vision of the past is skewed terribly because we are sitting here thinking about an England, a Scotland, a Wales, an Ireland, you know, and a France. We have these pre... You know, and by the way, they're so recent that half of those divisions were made in the Second World War. Europe and Asia was divided in the second. So we're not even talking thousands of years old. By the First and Second World War, Europe took on a brand new shape, so to speak.
The new nations of...
The new nations. So how outlandish is it to say that thousands of years ago, when these land bridges existed, you're not... You see, so immediately out the window goes these very... unsustainable ideas about an Ireland and an England. It was all one continent. It was all one landmass. They only become remote. They only become, you know, distant, far off, obscure places when the water is there.
So how far do you think we have to go back in order to get to a time when there was land bridges?
About 2,000 to 3,000 years BC, they disappeared.
Okay.
The man who discovered these or rediscovered them is Ulf Erlingsson. He's a Swedish geographer, and I believe this man, you can't get further up the totem pole than this guy. I mean, he's one of the top geologists in the world. And he actually wrote a book called Atlantis from a Geographer's Perspective. It's also been called Atlantis in Ireland. And he has shown that, he also shows the reasons for why the water level rose. About 6,000 years BC, he talks about the Storega tsunami.
Yeah.
People think tsunamis are the only things that happen in the East. The Storega tsunami should be studied by people to find out what a tsunami can really do. You're talking about hundreds of, you know, meters of water. And we also know that on the west coast of Ireland, not far from Norway, but on the west coast of Ireland, the waters rose. And because we know this, because when after a great gale or a storm on the Aran Islands on the west coast of Ireland, the water has receded and people are finding old settlements out there underneath the waterline. This is confirmed. They've done this in the Azores, and they've done it in Ireland, and they've done it in the Norway coast. So they know that the present coastlines were far inland. There was other coastlines. There was other settlements, all swallowed, all drenched and drowned by these huge, devastating tsunamis and the rising of the water. But the rising of the water exceeded, and so about 3,000 years BC, it seems like a long time, but it's not, the land bridges were there. The land bridges existed between Ireland and England. So don't you see what this means? It not only means that now we can explain how the stones of Stonehenge and other places like that might have been easily moved. There's no water there, so there's no problem. You can wheel them right across if you have to. See, all these problems, you know, are suddenly discovered when we realize that the science is in saying, no, there was no water here. This was all part of one land. Nobody was thinking in terms of Ireland. Do you know that the ages that I'm talking about, the era in which I'm talking about, the cities of Britain didn't exist? We're talking about a period that didn't have Glasgow and Edinburgh and London and Belfast and Dublin. This is what people need to wrap their minds around, is we are not talking about an Ireland as a nation. Yeah. Certainly I'm not. I understand where the word Ireland comes from. It's just a term that retained, it's just one of the countries that retained a very illustrious title.
Mm.
The Aria were all over the world. So when my book is called The Irish Origins of Civilization, it's really to be called The Aryan Origins of Civilization, or The Aria Origins of Civilization.
But that's a very controversial title, I guess.
It's always controversial when people don't have the facts.
Sure, exactly, right? Yeah.
When you realize that the Aria is a group of people from any civilization, black, white, you know, polka dot, I don't care, we're talking about, descendants of the dragon bloodline, because, if we really start at the beginning, this book was written after my Atlantis book for a reason. I had to start with my Atlantis book to sketch in the background of this history that I wanted to get into. That's why it took so long. You're talking about 20, 30 years here. I could not embark upon the true history of Ireland or Britain or Scandinavia until you first laid the groundwork for Atlantis.
Mm, that's right.
Ulf Erlingsson, in his own way, is sort of doing the same thing. You know, in his own way, as a mainstream scientist, he's sort of, dabbling in that area, thinking, maybe there was an ancient civilization. Of course there was. It's in all the myths and legends of the world. So you can't talk about the West, Northwest, and the lands of Hyperborea and Ultima Thule, you see, and all of this.
Yeah.
You can't even, it's ludicrous, preposterous, outrageous to begin a history of Britain or history of Ireland without talking first about Atlantis.
Mm.
You know, for instance, one example, one of the earliest settlements of Ireland at the time of the called the Coming of the Gods, and it's all in the book, but one of the ancient, they're called Gaelic, but they're really megalithic tribes of wizards. And they said that their continents, they had arrived because their lands had been destroyed.
Mm.
They come from four different islands, they said. Four great continents or four islands where these ancient Druidic Magi lived have been destroyed in the famous deluge about 13,000 years ago. These people arrive in Ireland's shores. And one of the islands that they're from, in Gaelic, is called Murias.
Mm.
Well, it doesn't take a massive stretch of the imagination to realize that that word Murias is the same as Lemurias.
That's right.
Particularly when you know that the letter L is a the. Mm. Just in the same way that the French use le or la today as a the, L apostrophe, whatever, right? In ancient times it was a the.
So Lemuria, yeah.
Right. So here we have it in Gaelic legends of the earliest period. They're from Murias. Mm. Yeah, from Lemuria. And we didn't write it. There it is. They're telling you.
Mm.
So they're from, Atlan, Atlantis, Leonice, Avalon. You see, we've got the whole story there that these people are coming. So it's very important to realize that Ireland and England and Scotland and Wales and also Scandinavia are remnants of old Atlantis. They're remnants of a very large continent known as Appalachia that probably once stretched even as far as Greenland. And Iceland encompassed even those islands.
Yeah.
But most of it sank beneath the waves, just in the same way that these land bridges did. So the Irish, the people we're calling today Irish, we mistake them as a racial title or a national title because it's been adopted.
Hmm.
Again, adopted very recently. Ireland has had dozens of names for its country.
Yeah.
Those people, their ancient forefathers, their traditions of people continually saying, "We came from the West, we came from the West, we came from the West," to Ireland, are coming from other land masses that connected that were destroyed.
Sure.
And the might of the cataclysm of these lands was so intense that it forced these natives from their own habitat to migrate and to evacuate. Basically, it was mass evacuation from England and Ireland. Again, let's look at the land bridge question. It's quite difficult to conceive of a mass evacuation if there's nothing but the English Channel there and the Irish Sea.
Mm.
It is much different question. The image in your mind is radically transformed when you can see that there are land bridges there. It's walkable.
Do you talk about the Dogger Bank or Dogger Island? I saw a picture of this.
Yeah. First of all, the word is fascinating. Dogger, from the dog.
Mm.
People of the dog. I believe that the dog was like Anubis. See, actually, I don't want to get into too many, what are they called? Asides? Digressions or whatever, but the concept of the dog, I believe Anubis, the cult of Anubis, is in Irish. It came from the West also.
Mm-hmm.
Because Anubis' earliest title meant nomad,
mm-hmm.
or the traveler, the one who had traveled. And an early precursor of Horus, by the way. Horus, you see, a lot of what we've got to understand about Egyptian mythology is that all the gods that you know from Egyptian mythology were based on earlier gods. Mm-hmm. They're morphed out of earlier gods. Horus grew out of a god. Horus morphed out of a god called Mento or Mentu. And Mentu was called the greater, what was his name? It was the foremost of the Westerners.
Hmm.
So there's that Western connection.
Yeah.
So I got this whole thing going where I believe that, you know, many of the, I stress pre-dynastic gods, pre-dynastic cities of Egypt are transplanted. And it's simple logic. See, to me, there's never been a stumbling block because I've never been indoctrinated by the education that has been given to us. If somebody tells me that migrating tribes, and remember, tells you with no qualm, there is no hint of question, there is no qualm, there is no resistance against Eastern groups migrating, walking. Migrating means on horseback. Let's again be very specific about what we're talking about here. Mm-hmm. They're either walking or they're riding, and they're moving eastward. And there's not an authority in this world that doubts that that could have taken place. But as soon as you say there are people who can walk and ride from the west to the east, oh my God, it's like you just said something, you know, foul, you know?
Yeah.
It's like you said, how's your varicose veins to the queen or something? You know, it's like you've suddenly gone against the taboo. In my mind, no such taboo exists. Is there some inbuilt, implant in the brain or some sort of a, you know, was there some sort of immigration line we don't know about, you know, or some sort of passport regulation that we didn't know about in ancient times that stopped you from moving from the west to the east?
Yeah.
The only one that people will throw in your face is the water.
Mm.
Well, thanks to Ulf Erlingsson and all these people, it don't exist. Those final arguments for the fact that there was a, you know, an inhibited movement from the west is utterly thrown aside.
Mm.
And then if you overlay what I'm talking about, which is that there was also a motivating factor for movement, upheavals of cataclysmic, unimaginable proportions, right? Once you start factoring that in, we're talking about tsunamis, we're talking about, you know, huge shifts in the ocean bed,
sure.
The sinking of vast areas of continent like they've seen today.
Mm.
And I think it was a couple of months ago, they've even seen this phenomenon where whole areas of an island or a land will sink. It's in our historical time they've noticed this.
Exactly, and the planet is always under constant changing, you know.
Yep, just tectonic trouble.
Just look at what, in a way, actually is happening now. If you look at the recent months or weeks on the British Isles, England has been underwater.
That's right.
Something is happening there.
Absolutely.
Couldn't this happen before? You know.
That's right. And so I am a believer, you know, that if something happens today, it could have happened yesterday.
Yeah.
But if you don't see something happening today, like it's impossible today, then it's impossible yesterday. When you see today people being swamped, in Belfast they had torrential rains, which basically drowned Belfast for a couple of days. I mean, huge amount of water, you know, incredible depth, 5 feet of water, something like that. What do people do? They leave their homes.
That's right.
They go to either higher ground, you see, or in extreme cases like the one in Indonesia, people will have to leave the entire region.
Mm.
Well, if you can see that and there's not a question about that, you're not going down there to interview people. Are you leaving? Are you walking? Where are you going? Of course they're leaving. So it's the same. Human beings react the same. You know, millennia goes by, it doesn't matter. So we're seeing a massed and forced evacuation.
Mm.
Now, granted, within the minds of these people who are now seeking refuge on the continent, the hardy ones, some of these people are going to want to return because that's what you do, isn't it? You wait till the worst has passed, and then you try to go back and get yourself involved with the restoration, if it's possible. In understanding what we've just said is the key to the whole problem of history, is the key to the problem of the Celts, and it answers this problem about the east to west, west to east movement of civilization. The Arya are the ex-Atlanteans that I believe are connected, you know, to the Dragon Court and the old Atlantean bloodline, you know, which we've gone into in other works. This is very important to realize why the symbol of the serpent would still be used in Ireland when there's no physical snakes there, you see, and why the Druids would call themselves the Nadreds, which also represents the serpent, you see, why St. Patrick would come and declare he has, you know, banished the serpents from the land, you know, we're talking about a lot of interesting things here. How come the same artwork exists in Scandinavia of the serpentine designs as it does in Ireland and the endless connections? You know, and why it is that the Vikings had serpent-shaped boats, and the only other place you see those is in Egyptian art, where Ra or Horus is going across the sky
That's
in a serpent-shaped boat.
Of course.
You know, so we got questions here. They're digging up Caucasian mummies. They're digging up Caucasian travelers in the deepest reaches of Nubia.
Mm.
You know, like I say, Hieraconopolis and Abu Sir. I believe that the word Abu Sir, which is again one of the ancient sites of Egypt, and it's at Abu Sir that the earliest solar temples are found. So in my other work, we talk about solar cults and stellar cults. Well, the earliest solar cult temples are found in a place called Abu Sir. Mm. I actually believe that the word Sir means the West.
Really?
S-I-R or S-I-E-R. We don't want to get into all the spellings. But it turns out to mean the West.
Hmm.
You find that word root in the term Osiris or Osiris.
All right. You see? Yeah, that's right.
You also find it in the word for Pharaoh. Because Pharaoh is not a word that the Egyptians ever used for their kings. That's a word that was adopted by outsiders like the Romans and the Greeks. They called Pharaoh, Paro, you know, Para, the great father or the great brother.
Mm.
The Egyptians never used that word for their kings. They used a word Sira.
Yeah.
S-E-R-A or Z-E-R-A. Zira or Sira. Very like the Indian word for Sura. Surya, meaning the sun.
Mm-hmm.
And Shira, meaning lion. And we know that the pharaohs were connected to the symbol of the lion because they used to wear the lion's tail. You know, and anyone who knows this knows that the symbol of the lion was key to the pharaoh. The priests were symbolized by the panther, you know,
mm-hmm.
God.
Mm-hmm.
They'd wear the panther pelt. And the pharaoh was always associated with the lion. Well, he called himself Sira, which I believe also means the lion or the sun, the solar king.
Mm.
But I also believe that the second derivation of the word Sira means the west.
Mm.
It's where we get the word Syria from, the country of Syria.
Yeah.
Syria actually means, can you believe this? Syria actually means the land of the Westerners.
Really?
Iran means the land of iron. There is no difference etymologically between the name for Iran, and Ireland, or Erin. They're just
very
pure,
similar.
They're the same word.
That's right.
It's just that the vowels have shifted over time.
But this is someone that knows something then, because Iran wasn't referred to as Iran
Persia.
Before the... Like, when was it carved up? After the Second World War,
You know? Iran is a later name, you know, meaning the land of iron.
Yeah.
And Erin, there's a lot of iron in Ireland.
Yeah.
See, again, you know, what my book explores is whether or not there's even a... What my book explores is whether or not there was even a possibility of the great civilizations existing in the East.
Mm-hmm.
See, me personally, I do not even believe that the East could sustain the great empires that we're told that existed there.
Mm. Interesting.
Yeah, from the earliest times.
Mm-hmm.
Only certain places could do it, and only they could hold on at certain periods of, you know, the season. Egypt was one, and there are a few others, but to try and give us this a notion that all civilization started in the East and then got to the West is a lie, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And it's even more of a lie when you realize that those civilizations that are known to have existed in Turkey, in Babylon, Sumeria, in the land of the Amorites, and in Egypt, were founded by Westerners.
Hmm.
Now, I don't care what kind of, you know, bugbear people have got or what kind of interpretations they want to give to this. You know, they're all hung up about, you know, what's he talking about here? Is he talking about something to do with the white race being superior? No, that's all in other people's brains.
Yeah.
I'm not into any of that. I'm not talking about race. I'm talking about caste.
Yeah.
I'm talking about the Arya, who are a spiritual elect, right? Civilizations and buildings... of temples, shrines, colleges aren't built by just yokel locals who maybe bicker about, you know, what race they are and what religion they follow. They're built by the makers of civilization.
Hmm.
Right? All culture is built based out of the few bards, the few minstrels, the few musicians, the few architects. It's not everybody.
That's right.
Right? It's a very, very small coterie of very, very, magnificent human beings who in ancient times were known as the Hierophants, so the elders, you know, the priests of old. These were the guys who were creating culture wherever they went. And those individuals were able to have easy commerce because there was no water. They were able to travel in times past into the West, from the West into the East.
Mm. So we have the main kind of thing that you always want to return to, that is, there are so many scholars out there, you know, looking at ancient history, and either it's just because, you know, they're totally missing this area completely, or they don't look at it because simply it hasn't entered their mind for some reason or whatever. But, you know, why the downplay of this theory? Why the incredible, you know, severe attack against it, so to speak?
Right. Well, because the real reason is because it was very, very important for people. Remember, you're not talking about historians. You're talking about the people who fund historians. You're talking about the people who open the universities and fund the universities. We're not talking, my qualm is not with individual historians any more than it was with those individual tour guides reading their script, right? You know what I mean? So what we're dealing with here is the establishment that funds this subject of history, which is about 200 years old, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the History is a very recent subject.
It is.
Yeah, half of the excavations in the world, you know, these famous excavations that are being done all over the world.
Yeah.
Most excavators and archaeologists will tell you that about 2 to 5% of the dig is done.
Yeah.
At every place. When we hear about an excavation, we have this some idea that they've dug up the lot.
Hmm.
They've dug up 1, 2, 3, 4, or 5%. I don't think there's a dig anywhere in the world where they've done full justice to it. So they're, you know, they're scratching in the dark still.
And they're still finding so much, you know. Look at Cairo, Egypt, you know, they're still finding, this arch, you know, arch. Mm-hmm.
Or Katl Hayyok. Right now they're over there again in Katl Hayyok. Or remember at the time of the Minoan civilization?
Yeah.
You know, we know something about the Minoans. Well, you will in about 200 years when you finish digging it up.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, what do we know right now? I believe that my research is in many ways ahead. I believe that, see, I have no problem realizing that we're going to catch up with what I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. Because I have got the proof. I have proved it to myself. That this is a fact, and therefore, you know, and every day people are sending me proofs from around the world.
Mm.
You yourself on Red Ice had a guy from New Zealand showing that, you know, there was Caucasian ancestors of the Maori.
Sure, Martin Dutrieu, yeah,
right.
Sure.
Well, the Maori have never denied it.
Yeah.
Go to America, the American Indians are always telling you, we didn't build these mounds, it's not us, it was the Westerners, the Pahonas, they're called the Pahona, the white, tall, white, blue-eyed, blonde people from the East. Well, that's our West, isn't it?
Mm, that's right.
Yeah, well, look, if they can say it in the Americas, and there is an ocean in between, how dare we say in the East here, in Europe, that it couldn't have happened when there was no water? But you see, history is 200 years old. The first person to write on Egyptian history was Manetho, right, who wrote, he's writing 300 BC.
Okay.
Mm. I've just said to you that the history of Egypt goes back officially 3,000 years BC. Okay, and the first historian is writing only 300 years BC.
Mm.
So the first historian of Egypt, Manetho, you can look him up on Wikipedia, Manetho, is writing about the history of his country 300 years BC, but he's only got 2,000. He's writing about things that happened 2,000 to 3,000 years before his own time.
Yeah.
That's a historian for you.
Sheesh.
We got, you know, Herodotus doing the same measly job at the time of the Greeks. Then we come up to the Victorian age, in which, boy, you're talking about prejudice. Okay, they weren't. If anyone wants to know how skewed and ridiculously narrow and, you know, utterly prejudiced these beautiful objective historians can be, you only have to study, you know, the Darwinian period and the period of the Victorian, historians and the junk that they were talking about. I mean, you want some real way out crackpots? It was at this point because they were being motivated from political reasons.
Mm-hmm.
So, first of all, I believe that they are not looking, because remember, there's an old, I don't even remember, but some of your listeners may know, there's actually a technical term for seeing what you're programmed to see, or you only see what it is that's shown in front of you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what was that movie with Johnny Depp, you know, where he acts Jack the Ripper? They really brought that out. He was a Mason, and there was a whole thing about the Masonic.
It was
Johnny Depp or something like that.
I think I'm ninth gate here, but no, of course not. Oh, shit, how can I forget this? Yeah, I know which
movie. You remember, but in that movie, they also make that point that people are trained to see only what is in front of them.
Yeah.
And that goes for scientists, too. I actually believe that some of these scientists and historians are the most narrow-minded of all people.
Yeah.
But do not, just like I found out that there is an overt campaign of destruction, let us be under no illusion that there is an overt, covert operation to destroy this knowledge. If there wasn't, then Emmanuel Velikovsky would have been doing very well in his professional life.
That's right.
Commons Beaumont would be known to people. People like me say Commons Beaumont, and it goes right across people. Well, there you go. You know, Sigmund Freud would not have been murdered, because that's in fact what happened. Sigmund Freud himself didn't just die, like we've been told. He was taken out, and that we've got the proof. You know, the list is endless of the scholars that have been suppressed, the overt campaign. You know, Ignatius Donnelly, who was one of the most incredible American writers who first looked into the whole question of Atlantis and the West to East movement. He had Lincoln on his side. Lincoln wanted to dedicate one of the Navy's boats, the American Navy boats, to go and seek for Atlantis to help Donnelly, you know, back up his theories.
Yeah, yeah.
But unfortunately, he was assassinated before that could happen.
Hmm.
You know, so, you know, Commons Beaumont, Connor McDarry, Anna Wilkes, these people whose footsteps I'm following in, rewriting this incredible story. These are people who were not as myopic. They weren't trained in the lie machinery of history. which I believe is one of the most controlled of all subjects because it's imperative. The Vatican even had restrictions on traveling to the West. Yeah. This nonsense of the flat world. And people laugh when they hear that. They go, oh, it's like a sort of, you know, over your coffee and tea, you kind of laugh at that. Mm. Hang on a minute. Do you know the real reason for that? That these people were in such pathological fear that you might find out about Albion, that you might travel, you know, clever, intelligent, wealthy, merchant men might go and find out again about England and Ireland and realize, oh my God, you're going to tell me that Jerusalem and Rome and Athens are not the center of civilization?
Sure, yeah.
Well, that's what would have happened. So they tried to put this fear that the earth is flat and you're going to fall off the edge of the world if you travel too far to the West. And I mean, look at the lengths that they will go. I mean, you really follow what I'm saying here and realize that these people will go to the length to even tell you that the earth is flat and forbid you to get in a boat and travel west because they will come up with anything to stop you from going. They're in such fear that this truth will come out. They send the might of the Roman army to destroy the culture of the Druids, what was left of them. Just like I said, get out of your mind that about the notion of Ireland being this little remote island that, you know, left on its own up there on the eastern seaboard. Get out of your mind that Druids were guys, you know, who were just walking around in white robes only in one country.
Yeah.
Sort of hanging out, you know, climbing the oak tree over there, you know, and playing the harp in, you know, Anglesey, Wales. And realize that that's a false impression that's been given. The Drua, or the Druhus, are found as far away as the Brahmins of India. They're found in the schools of Pythagoras. They're found in Egypt. They're found in Africa under different names. These people were a worldwide organization. What was left of them was destroyed. The Roman army and the Egyptian, in the later days, the colleges all over the world that the Druids had put up were destroyed. You find churches on them today. You find cities built over them today. The word city is actually a Gaelic word, in fact. We find all of these temples taken down. We find churches. We find institutes. We find shrines and other, you know, groups, other sects, other religions. Taking these traditions, taking these elements from the old Druidic culture. But we have been told by historians a couple of very, very, very important fallacies. And I am more than happy to start seeing that some these fallacies are now radically being, you know, refuted. Not just by me, but in the, we've had now about 20 years. You know, Eric von den Eicken, but again, I can think going back to Emanuel Velikovsky and Beaumont. Yeah. And again, now in the last 10, 15 years with Ahmed Osman and Ralph Ellis. I mean, you've had Ralph Ellis on your show.
Sure,
I consider him one of the greatest scholars that the world has ever produced. You know, and we've got others of Mustafa Gadala. These people I highly recommend people start reading. These are individuals who are refuting. But if you don't know about these people, then you're going to believe some of the lies of history. You know, let's go through a few of them. Well, the big one, there were no pre-Diluvian civilizations. It all begins, Henrik, 11,000 years ago when somebody sat down and wove a basket.
Oh, yeah, of course.
And, you know, with a prod, moved a few cows, you know, and started some commerce. Sure. You know what I mean? Yeah. Of course, they stumbled over the pyramid and thought, oh, well, I wonder what that is. While they did all of this.
Yeah.
And but no. And even though Graham Hancock in a wetsuit can go and down and dive under and film it for you, we still told there's no such thing as pre-Diluvian.
Sure.
You know, there's no land bridges. They've taken photographs of million-year-old land bridges now between, was it India and Ceylon?
Yeah, India and Sri Lanka.
Sri Lanka.
Yeah, that's right.
I'm using the old term Ceylon, but Sri Lanka.
Exactly. That's the old term. Okay.
Yeah. It shows you about how old I am. But anyway, they go. Yeah, this is not hallucination.
There was
a movement of a massively evolved civilization between. Now you go to the average Sri Lankan, well, he just wants to kill Hindus, and the Hindus want to butcher him. You know, they're not interested in any of that stuff.
Yeah.
Well, you go to Ireland now. What are they interested in? You know, whatever. I don't know even. I mean, it's just whatever they're interested in is what they're doing. They don't care about any of that stuff.
Yeah.
They think they have no idea how ancient their own culture is.
That's right.
Or their own language. They're into whatever gods and whatever nonsense they're into now, and earning a living and doing what everybody's doing. They're sitting right on it, and they don't even know it. So there's it makes life so much easier when you realize there's no pre-Diluvian continents. Early man, primitive man is a rude and malignant and malevolent creature, the skin-wearing, bone-chucking, you know, primitive.
Sure, hunter-gatherer.
A hunter-gatherer. And look at us, how fantastically evolved we are, that we don't live in caves.
We don't gather stuff, right?
That's right. Yeah. You know, I mean, Commons Beaumont shot to pieces that whole idea about the cave dwellers living in caves.
Mm.
No, no. Taking refuge in caves, because the earth is going through a Charlton Heston disaster, you know, movie mm-hmm. that you couldn't imagine.
Mm.
Yeah, you'd be taking refuge in caves. Living in caves? No. Refuge in caves? Yes.
Mm.
Right? But again, we're told, no, 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 they were all rude. And it's a miracle to us that they could do this miraculous artwork.
Mm,
boy,
yeah.
These guys were primitive, but wow, we dig their artwork. That the Mesolithic and Megalithic sites, which are throughout the whole world, not just the Northwest, they're constructed by different unrelated races.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, there's no connection. If you go down to the Pelasgians, who are the forerunners of the Greeks, they're identical to the ones that are in Ireland. They're not identical to any official scholar. Oh, they're all different. The ones in Brittany, the ones in Africa, these cave paintings that you're talking about over there, these guys over here, and we found some over there, and in northern Russia we got some. Yeah, hey, we've even got the Zimbabwe ruins down in Africa, boy, and Machu Picchu. It's all different.
Mm.
It's all guys just separate. No connections between them at all.
Right.
There they are, but there's no connection between the builders.
Yeah.
And then we're told that the ambassadors of civilization, here we're talking about civilization, oh, but that was created by Greeks, Romans, and Jews.
Mm-hmm.
You don't need to know anything more than that. We'll give you a PhD budget. You're interested in archaeology? We love you. Great. Here's a budget. Go out and study some Roman walls up there in bloody Scotland. You know, get your nose down into those dikes and into those, Roman and Greek ruins.
Yeah.
AD.
Hmm.
Keep your focus on AD. This Roman road is what you'll get your PhD. These Roman urns, this bit of broken Greek pottery. How did they do it? Find out. Chariot wheels of the Greeks. You know, what did they fight? Well, you know, to me, that's of no interest.
Yeah.
I follow in the realm of Tolkien. He said everything after a certain period is like not even worth studying, you know, because the whole thing was going on before that. But you better believe that if you focus your intention on megalithic Ireland or ancient civilization, you're going nowhere.
Mm.
They're going to have you under strict controls. But you focus your attention on the post-Christian era or the Romans and the Greeks or whoever else, and you'll have budgets galore.
Sure.
So this is another lie. Then we got this thing where it connects. The various elements of civilization were brought by a group called the Chosen People who moved from the east to the west.
Mm-hmm.
Millions and millions of people believe it.
Mm.
Christians, Jews, you know, the world.
Mm.
It's those guys, the Chosen People. Who are the Chosen People, you might ask? Oh, well, we don't know. It's those guys mentioned in the Bible. Could they have been Egyptian pharaohs, a dynasty of Egyptian royalty and nobility, like Ralph Ellis, Ahmed Osman, and Mustafa Gadala have discovered, like Sigmund Freud hinted years ago? Oh, we don't know anything about that. It's just those guys in the Bible, right? They brought it all, didn't they?
Mm. Hmm.
But they don't tell you that their god Jehovah, Yahweh, or Yahweh, could have been based on the yew tree of the Druids.
Mm.
There's an old god of the tree, the burning bush.
Mm,
where did that come from? They don't tell you about all the tree symbolism in the Bible.
Mm.
You want to get into something about Druidism, we can use the Bible. You get the amount of Druidism in the Bible would stun you when you start looking at it in another way.
Fascinating.
Yeah, Jordan Maxwell has gone into this. He was, again, one of the people that turned me on to this.
Mm-hmm.
He told me, Jordan Maxwell taught me more about my own country than anybody ever had done.
Fascinating.
You got to be away from the mountain to see the peak.
That's
because you think you know a damn thing, he said to me. He says, you think you know about your own land? Let me instruct you. You know what I mean? And I was all ears. He said, yeah, tell me. You know, I didn't. I'm thinking you're going to study something, you know, in your life. How did I, you know that it was going to be this land that I lived in blindly, like a blind sheep?
Hmm.
You hadn't a clue, you know, until it's pointed out to you what it's about, you know?
Yeah.
Well, we got that the Jews are uniquely distinguished. They possessed a naturally religious and moral disposition and were a truly God-inspired chosen people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the first monotheists,
mm-hmm.
the only moral people in the world. God loves it, only them. We're not having any talk of any Goths or any Nords or any Celts or any Brahmins or any Chaldeans or any Phoenicians or Babylonians. No, they're all worshippers of the devil. They're all worshippers of Moloch. They're all hedonistic, completely off the wall. It's only this one little group that is so sacred and beloved to God.
Sure.
Every other nation can just be obliterated.
Hmm.
Right? This is another lie.
Hmm.
We're told that the Jews were slaves in Egypt and hard-pressed to preserve their national identity and beliefs.
Hmm.
Yeah, is that a fact? Turns out now that we find there is no such thing as oppression. In fact, they were a bunch of pharaohs in their own right, nobility no less.
Hmm.
They were doing the oppressing.
Hmm.
Another lie? Egyptian religion and culture has no effect on Jewish beliefs and lifestyle. Right? Because the Jews barely mention Egypt, and when they in the Bible and the Christians, and when they do, it's in derogatory terms, like, oh, well, those pagans, good thing we got away from there, huh? Us and our Jehovah, and we created a new religion. Turns out, the latest research is showing you that there the connections between Egypt and the so-called Israelites is, you know, the
hand in glove. Yeah.
Nothing we've been told for hundreds of years is true.
Mm.
Oh, yeah, the Hebrew language, whatever that is, the Hebrew language has no connection again to the Egyptian.
Mm.
Complete and utter lie. Scholars are finding out that the so-called Hebrew letters, that people, you know, you've seen them write the left or right,
sure,
is Egyptian.
Really?
That was the hieratic writing of Egypt. Wasn't the hieroglyphics, that was only for certain purposes. The actual writing of the 22 letters of what's called Hebrew is actually the 22 letters of the Egyptian alphabet that everyone says is a mysterious lost alphabet.
Really?
Well, doesn't it make sense that if the Hebrews and the so-called Israelites, Levites, turn out to be a pharaonic dynasty, of course it's Egyptian. They were Egyptian.
That's right.
So it's a misnomer to talk about the Hebrew alphabet if the Hebrews were Egyptian pharaohs. You see how many things get cleared up when you have the facts? We better be really optimistic about the age we're living in. You know, I get too many emails going, oh man, it's all suck, it's all going downhill. Yeah, like I've always said, if something needs to be broken, something's going downhill, it probably needs to go, let it go. Stop crying over it.
That's right.
A sick, disgusting, rotten, filthy, you know, corrupt edifice should be having problems. I'm glad to see it rot. But don't you start, you know, dressing in black and putting on black armbands for it. What you're seeing is the death of a corrupt, you know, system, a corrupt milieu. Let it go. Start going back to origins and discovering something incredible about the world and about the age of revelation in which we're living. Here's another one. The Jews or the Israelites are never been given to idolatry. What lies? What lies? You know, that they only worship the unseen God. The whole of the Bible is filled with idolatry. Well, Judaism is filled with it. You know, don't believe him? Go and, you know, try to burn a Torah. Right? Same in Mecca. But, I mean, you know, Jordan Maxwell and others have explored the whole idolatry question. Now, it's covered up, of course, you wouldn't notice it.
Sure.
And here's one of the most important. The Bible provides accurate accounts of historical occurrences. Oh, the Bible's history. Don't question the Bible. What are you talking about? Yeah, it's just poetic language. You know, they wrote in sort of old, archaic terms. But that happened. Did it? We're actually, I mean, you're going to, if you really, really want to have major problems in your life, consider the Bible to be history. If you're looking to really find out what the hell has been going on this planet, don't ever make that mistake. You can look at the Bible as a historical document. That's not what I'm saying. The Bible is a historical document. There are historical elements to it. But the Bible's stories, those things that are meant to be written, is not history. Tell me it's astrotheology, and I might agree with you.